This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is long overdue, and I think the sooner they do this, I think it will give a sense to the government that, this trickery that there is an ongoing implementation of the peace agreement is no longer accepted by the world at large.
That's Isaac Gang, the appointed U.S. representative of South Sudan. Details coming up. Also, South African bus drivers are striking for better pay and working conditions. And at least two people have died in confirmed cases of the Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the White House issued a rare statement yesterday on South Sudan expressing its frustration with the ongoing conflict while questioning the inclusivity of the transitional government of national unity. It was met with anger by a top South Sudan diplomat in the U.S. who called the statement a step backward for peace negotiations. Ayan Bior has more from Washington.
The government of South Sudan has lost credibility, and the United States is losing patience, says the statement issued by the White House. It also said the government's leaders have squandered its partnership with the U.S. after pilfering the wealth of South Sudan and killing its own people. Ambassador Gordon Boy, the charge of the affairs of South Sudan's embassy in Washington, thinks the strongly worded statement could have unintended consequences.
This one is sending a wrong signal to the rebels. If the United States, the White House position that they have taken today, will embolden the opposition, because why would the opposition keep talking to the government that has been declared as not credible, you see? So it's not helpful to the peace process.
The statement says the United States is, quote, deeply frustrated with the lack of progress toward an agreement, and it must ensure our shared efforts reflect the urgency of the situation. It says the U.S. will initiate a comprehensive review of its assistance programs to South Sudan, namely the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission and other mechanisms that support the 2015 peace agreement. Isaac Gang, appointed by former First Vice President Riek Machar as the U.S. representative of the SPLM in opposition, says the frustrated tone of the statement is shared by many, and his party welcomes the new aggressive position taken by the White House.
This is long overdue, and I think the sooner they do this, I think it will give a sense to the government that, this trickery that there is an ongoing implementation of the peace agreement is no longer accepted by the world at large. And the sooner the actions are taken, the sooner this government will realize that it is not business as usual.
Don Moses, a South Sudanese-American in the East Coast state of Virginia, says recent demands by top U.S. officials to adhere to the ceasefire agreement and allow unhindered humanitarian access have been ignored. He says he's surprised the statement did not come sooner.
One thing about South Sudan is people have learned to buy time. But what they didn't know is that this government, the Trump administration, is not going to continue to play that game. You know, whereby they buy time and then they get away with things. It's not going to be the same game like what they did when Obama administration was, in power.
Nelson Laponi, another South Sudanese American in the southern state of Texas, also embraces the White House statement and the Trump administration's intention to hold the perpetrators of crimes accountable.
There are very few people who are in the government there, and they take advantage of the situation right now. Instead of bringing that war to an end, they escalate the war. And I think the people are tired and sick and they're really frustrated.
The White House's assessment is that the transitional government of national unity in South Sudan is no longer inclusive, a view that Ambassador Boy is quick to dismiss.
You better ask the White House about the definition of inclusivity. Is it the representation of political parties? Is it the tribal representation? It is them to define it. But in our definition, the government we have, if it is IO, there is IO in the government. If it is FDs, John Luke and Madhud Biara are in the government. If it is the IG, they are there. If it is other political parties, they are there. If it is if the inclusivity is defined based on party membership in the Tigonu, then all the parties are involved. If the tribal one, all the tribes are there.
The White House statement does not mention the various opposition forces. Instead, it places blame for the continued bloodshed directly on the government, which bears responsibility for protecting its citizens, according to the statement. It also blames the forced exile of key leadership representatives and signatories of the 2015 peace agreement, such as Riek Machar, on President Salva Kiir. The statement is consistent with recent actions by the U.S. State Department that signal a more aggressive approach to the conflict in South Sudan. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
In response to the White House statement, South Sudan Minister of Cabinet Affairs Martin Elias Lumoro says the United States should talk with Salva Kiir's administration and avoid what he calls intimidation and threats. Nabil Biagio reports from Juba for VOA that Lumoro accuses the U.S. and other members of the international community of favoring rebel groups while putting all the blame for the continued fighting on the government. Lumoro rejects complaints that the transitional government of national unity is not inclusive, pointing out that some former detainees are in the government. The White House says the only path to peace for South Sudan is through a negotiated arrangement for an inclusive government. It also says the U.S. is losing patience with the Juba government. Lumoro says if so, the U.S. should engage with the government, saying we have open doors. South African bus drivers are striking for better pay and working conditions that has put extra pressure on the minibus taxi industry as commuters scramble for alternatives. The strike is in its fourth week, and negotiations between employers and the unions have deadlocked several times. For most locals, public transport is the only way to get around. Strikes and labor disputes are a regular occurrence in the country. One labor relations expert says a lack of trust between employers and employees is a key driver of the conflict. From Johannesburg, Nadia Same has the story.
Dixie Tupe is a domestic worker in Johannesburg's northern suburbs. She travels in from the south every day using public transport. She now has to wake up 2 hours earlier than normal to get to work on time. During the strike, bus commuters are forced to use minibus taxis. It's resulted in queues at taxi ranks snaking for several miles.
We get at work late. And then, you know, our bosses, they get angry at us. Normally it gets me 2 hours, but now it's 4.5 hours to get home and to get to work.
She says the strike is frustrating and a major inconvenience, but many of the people queuing at the taxi rank understand the bus driver's concerns, as they cannot make ends meet with their current salaries, which come to less than $1,000 per month. Drivers initially demanded 12% increases. They've dropped that to 9%, but the employer is offering 8.75%. Also at issue is overnight work. The negotiations have so far been slow and frustrating. In the World Competitiveness Report for 2017-2018, South Africa ranks dead last in the labor relations category. That's 137th. Out of 137 countries, so it may be no surprise that the economy is regularly rocked by protracted strike action. Javi Selier, employment relations expert and lecturer at the University of Stellenbosch Business School, explains.
The largest contributor to the finding is the lack of trust that we experience in the relationship between management and employees in a large number of South African companies. Unfortunately, this poor employment relationship negatively impacts on company performance, and then on a cumulative basis, one can argue that there is also a negative impact on the South African economy.
Celia says in many companies, employees are not given a voice, and this is an important detail when developing trust and collaboration.
For many years in South Africa, we have focused maybe too much on the formal side of the employment relationship. We have very advanced labor legislation in South Africa, but in the process, the relationship part of the employment relationship has really suffered. This has been the case now for at least the last 4 to 5 years.
Celia has been studying the relationship between managers and their teams for several years. This is what he's found.
We do not properly value those that are in our employment, and therefore we do not recognize the various contributions that they could make through their inputs into decision-making processes in South African companies.
To mend the situation, Celia says a good place to start would be to increase the level of interaction between managers and the workforce. This includes honest discussions about the state of the business and plans for the future. This, he says, could allow all parties to feel connected to the companies where they spend most of their time. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
The South African government is asking the people of Cape Town to continue to do their best to save water as the city battles one of the driest periods in the country's history. Cape Town's 6 supply reservoirs are just 18% full. City authorities have called on each resident to use no more than 50 litres of water a day. As part of our series looking at the crisis, Darren Taylor visits two very different families to find out how they're handling the water crisis.
It's a typical Sunday afternoon in middle-class suburbia north of Cape Town. Meat sizzles on the barbecue, ice hits a glass to cool a drink. An awning protects Eddie and Hester Page from the sun.
On days like today when it's so hot, we would use a mist sprayer on the patio the whole day. If I had to open that sprayer now, it would be perished. The same with the sprinklers. We last watered the garden with the sprinklers 3 years ago.
These days, the middle-aged public relations officer finds herself remembering Cape Town's winters, once notoriously wet and cold, with fondness.
It used to rain continuously for 3 weeks. I would never have thought there would ever be a water shortage here. Never.
Hester, her father and her husband tuck into lunch. She says the drought has forced them to change their culture.
We were raised to flush the toilet every time you used it, or we would be in big trouble with our parents. Today we must do the complete opposite.
Hester says the family doesn't flush the toilet often anymore because it uses too much water. When they do, it's with recycled water.
We capture as much shower water as possible in buckets. We use that to either flush the toilets or for a plant that's really suffering. But at this point, everything in the garden's dead anyway.
The pages shower only in the morning and for no longer than 90 seconds each. At home in the evenings after work, they use a plastic bottle to spray a little water on their bodies to freshen up. She says she's now ashamed of how much water she used to waste. Hammers pound steel and a hooter blares to end the workday at a factory on the industrial outskirts of Cape Town. This is where Kribo de Veer, a 49-year-old machine operator, works. He lives in this dusty, dead-end street, the territory of mischievous teenagers and equally stray dogs. Kribo and his 45-year-old wife, Maria, live about 15 miles from the pages, but there's a world of difference between the families.
Mark is surprised he's being looked at as a suspect.
Maria fills a pot with water to boil beans for supper. Her children watch a crime show on TV. There are no tasteful ornaments here, no paintings on the fractured walls. The home is clean, but cramped. 17 people live on the windswept plot. Kribo is the only person with a steady income.
When I was growing up, the only water we had was from a farm dam. It was brackish, but we survived.
He and Maria have lived in poverty their entire lives. Kribo says his family is aware of the drought and tries to be careful with water. But Maria acknowledges that nothing special is being done to save it.
We have a washing machine, so we wash clothing. We all use the toilet, and we all bath at night. There are a lot of people, so we use a lot of water here.
Maria says bluntly that the household uses as much water as it needs, but she seems mildly embarrassed at the suggestion that the city administration would consider her family to be water wasters. Kribo interjects.
We cannot pay for the water because we are poor. Sometimes we don't even have money for food. Our sons cannot find jobs. The water bill for this place is too much. We owe about 15,000 rand.
Kribo agrees that his family should do more to save water, but adds that only wealthier citizens should pay for it because they use more of it. Some of the De Veers gather around a radio in their backyard, waving his crumpled, unpaid water bill at the red sky. Kribo declares, "It's going to rain a lot this winter because I have faith in God." I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Cape Town.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A team of experts is heading to the area where at least two people have died in confirmed cases of the Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Other deaths and ailing patients are being tested for the virus, which is very contagious and has a fatality rate about 50%. A health ministry is calling it a public health emergency with international impact. It is the ninth outbreak in the DRC since 1976. The last one was brought under control less than 10 months ago. The ministry says no new deaths have been reported since the current situation was reported last Thursday. All the cases are linked to the same clinic. The World Health Organization has freed up $1 million from an emergency contingency fund. The outbreak was reported about 30 kilometers from the northwest market town of Bikoro, which is on the shores of Lake Tumba in the Equator province. In Rwanda, refugees are complaining about conditions in the Kiziba camp in the western part of the country. The camp, which opened 20 years ago, holds about 17,000 people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, Rwandan forces have killed 12 refugees over the past few months when they were protesting conditions at the camp. News reports say the police have increased their presence at Kiziba. Authorities say there are routine patrols enhancing public order and crime prevention. Jean-Claude Rawama is the director of Refugee Affairs Unity in the Ministry of Disaster Management and Refugee Affairs. Reporter Eugene Uimana asked him about tensions in Kiziba camp and if they agree that the police are hindering refugees from going out of the camp.
That's not true. Refugees are free to move around. They're free to get out of the camp and do their business as usual. Although we have the police presence in that camp due to insecurity that has prevailed in that camp for a couple of weeks. But so far the situation is just coming back to normalcy. We don't have any problem now.
Are refugees allowed to grow food a worker's means of supporting themselves?
Yeah, they have that right. Unfortunately, we don't have really enough space for them to grow crops. But for those who can afford to rent some plot of lands, they are free to do so.
Tensions flared a few months ago when the police were accused of using excessive force to put down protests. Are there talks between the Rwandan government, UNHCR, and refugees over how to defuse tensions?
There are no talks between the government and UNHCR and refugees because we don't have fights between those sides. We are just fulfilling our responsibilities as the government. We are just ensuring that refugees are in secure and in safe environment, enjoying their rights, but they should also respect the laws of the land. I don't think that claiming your rights is equivalent to demonstrating. There are many ways of claiming your rights without resorting to violence, as they did. So we've been educating them, mobilizing them to use peaceful channels of communicating or presenting their grievances. But they have really disobeyed. They didn't follow our instructions, and that resulted or led to what happened, which is really unfortunate.
What is being done to improve conditions for those who remain in Kiziba camp?
They are getting food as usual. They are getting water. They are being treated, especially for those who felt sick. So I think Kiziba is really returning to the normal situation.
Rwanda, as a hosting country, is also involved in protecting over 172,000 other refugees in different camps. Are the conditions and the tensions in other camps similar to those at Kiziba?
We've been facing some scenes of demonstrations by the refugees in Kiziba, but in other camps, we don't really have problems.
There are reports that several thousand refugees from Kiziba have repatriated to the DRC in response to conditions in the camp. Can you confirm that figure?
That's not true. We can't really have thousands of people crossing the border without the government supervision or the government facilitation. We have normally what we call organized repatriation. That is a way of facilitating refugees willing to go back to their country of origin. So refugees are facilitated by the government, but also by the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. So we also have what we call spontaneous return. Spontaneous return is just a way of taking a decision individually to go back to his or her country of origin. So we haven't registered any repatriation, either spontaneous repatriation. Spontaneous repatriation is possible, but not to that extent.
Jean-Claude Rawama is the director of the Refugee Affairs Unity in the Ministry of Disaster Management and Refugees Affairs. He was speaking with reporter Eugene Uimana from Kigali, Rwanda. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terewale, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have agreed to end their political animosity. A discussion on Kenyan politics on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.